Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post, Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Swell.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up, in controversies and non-controversies, Netflix wants everyone to know that it is definitely not out of cash. It's got lots of cash. It's got money. Everybody needs to not leave Netflix, but also that layoffs are going to probably continue. Anyway, stock prices for the streamer dropped again last week amidst rumors that another round of layoffs were about to hit the service. This follows an earlier round of layoffs, of course, in which the streaming service shed about 150 jobs and comes as treasury rate hikes mean that making more debt-related purchases not so good, kind of expensive. Don't worry, Hollywood, though. Netflix still has lots of money. That's the message that they are sending out of their corporate headquarters. Even as danger looms, they're telling Variety that they're still buying lots of stuff, got a lot of interesting projects in the pipeline. Showrunners are coming to them with lots of good ideas at many price points. Many price points. The showrunners, they got 6-episode shows, 9-episode shows, depends on what you need. Netflix's big draw for creatives used to be monetary, right? Sure, the screen is a little smaller. Yeah, you're probably not going to win lots of Oscars. And no, you're not going to make a ton of money at the box office. But hey, we'll make you whole up front. Being made whole up front, very lucrative. These days, it's harder to say if that's true outside of, the few big stars for their tentpole features like Red Notice, all of whom got, dump trucks of cash, I believe, is the Netflix unit of payment. Dwayne Johnson got 2 dump trucks full of cash. Ryan Reynolds got 1.5 dump trucks full of cash, etc.
But Dwayne Johnson had to pull the dump trucks into his front yard with his biceps.
Probably his teeth.
Teeth, yeah.
And with a writer's strike, look, money is going to start getting tighter all around. There's a writer's strike in the distance as the WGA starts looking at how these streamers work and how residuals have kind of disappeared and where they're going to get a little more money out of Netflix to make up for the smaller writer rooms that don't last as long, et cetera, et cetera. Alyssa, If Netflix does not have a bottomless well of cash to throw at people, does that mean they're going to have to do something like figure out how to make good shows for less money?
Well, part of what I thought was interesting about the Variety piece that you're talking about is that it suggests that not only does Netflix not have the kind of cash on hand that it used to anymore, but that it can't offer creatives the kind of freedom that they are used to. And that was the other big part of the pitch. You would go to Shonda Rhimes or Ryan Murphy and say, hey, you're not going to have to deal with studio notes. You're not even going to have to deal with HBO style, like gracious, thoughtful studio notes. You can do whatever you want and we'll give you a boatload of cash for it. And, one of the things that piece pointed out is that, Ted Sarandos theoretically thinks that television shows should only run 3 seasons. Now, some of them are running shorter. The rap on Netflix was that it had data that and it knew exactly what viewers wanted and could sort of program to that and could program to niches, which would theoretically let people sort of pitch some of their passion projects while Netflix also made sort of more commercially viable stuff to hook people in. But if what Netflix is going to do is use the data to say, yeah, I think all stories should be between 18 and 27 episodes long. And there is data to indicate that nobody wants to stay in a world longer than this. That actually becomes a fairly stultifying environment. I think that the idea of unbridled creative freedom is always sort of a myth. And I think that there are always points in these companies evolutions when they end up getting a little bit more hands-on out of anxiety. I think the two of you may have read Tinderbox, The New Oral History of HBO, which recounts a period in the network's history after it had this original run of really golden original programming where you had some shifts in the executive ranks, you had, the company got acquired again, and the notes started coming in much more aggressively. The network started getting much more finicky about things. And, the network seemed less sure of itself as a result. I think Netflix is facing both, some cash tightness. It may be hitting sort of a ceiling on its subscribers, as we've discussed before on the podcast. And there appears to be some sort of anxiety setting in about whether this sort of creative freedom has really worked. I mean, if you look at Ryan Murphy's deal, that's been, you know, they spent, I think, $300 million to lure him away from FX. And the stuff that he's produced for them has been, by and large, like pretty disastrous and unpopular. Shonda Rhimes' deal with them has produced two shows, both of which have been quite successful. Bridgerton, which theoretically should have another 5 seasons in it if they do the sort of full run of books. And that may end up being sort of the exception to the 3 seasons rule just because it's based on pre-existing IP. The individual seasons have been very successful, etc. But then Inventing Anna was, you know, sort of a one-off miniseries. So, you know, they plunge a ton of money and, you know, creative leeway into the deals that they just haven't gotten a ton out of. And, you know, and if I am a creator, I look at Netflix and say, okay, they're maybe not going to give me the episodes that I want to tell this story. If I'm making a movie, okay, maybe they'll pay me up front, but they're not going to put any advertising spend into it unless it's an Oscar contender. And so I have no idea if people are going to see it, especially if it doesn't star a Hemsworth or a Ryan Reynolds. You know, what's so great about being on this service in the first place? You know, I mean, I think HBO has, you know, through some vicissitudes, always held on to its brand for quality. But I think Netflix's brand for quality has gone down as, and it, you know, it never had a lock on something like Sunday night programming. And so the downsides start to become a lot more apparent when they don't have both a lot of money and creative leeway to sweeten the deal.
Yeah, Peter, I mean, I guess that's the big question. I was like, why would I want to work for Netflix? What's the benefits if I'm a creative outside of just the simple fact of getting greenlit and everything? It's always hard to get something greenlit in Hollywood, whatever. But like, what's the value add for me if I want to go work for Netflix? Why would I want to do
so
that?
So you're asking this question because of this Variety story that has this great headline. Netflix has a message for Hollywood. We're still spending money, or in some versions it said, oh, we're not broke. Right. And like the opening to this story is that Netflix has actually set its production budgets, its content spend for 2022 and 2023, and doesn't plan to cut back. And so they're still going to be spending boatloads, truckloads, whatever the
dump trucks of money
yeah, on content, at least for this year and for next year. And they want creatives to know that. And it's pretty, I mean, they attribute all of this to a source with like a source close to Netflix or something. It's pretty obviously like the top of the Netflix comms shop is out there desperately trying to plant a story in Variety saying, look, we're still spending. Please don't abandon us. Because what Netflix is trying to do here is avoid a death spiral between the creatives and the audience, in which creatives abandon the streamer and then they have fewer shows, and then they also have less to abandon viewers, just as viewers are experiencing inflation, are looking to cut back, are sort of like thinking, do I really want to be paying for Netflix every month? And so Netflix really, really wants to avoid that and really doesn't want to end up in that situation. So I think Netflix has a bunch of issues related to their finances and their, you know, sort of their old strategy of we can just keep borrowing forever because money's cheap, is obviously not going to work nearly as well in a world of higher interest rates. But I want to take just a little bit of issue with Alyssa's argument that they're not going to be offering creative freedom anymore. That may be true in many cases. It does seem like they're going to clamp down in some ways, but I also think they have the ability to offer, if they want, some types of creative freedom. It may be that, for example, that there are showrunners, show creators out there who don't want to create something where if it's a hit, they've got to keep doing it for 7 seasons, where they just want to say, I want to do 2 or 3 seasons, and that's it. And that's something that you could take to Netflix. It may also be that there are creatives out there who have ideas for shows that might work at best at 4 or 5 or 6 episodes, rather than at, well, you know, we're at some other streamer or network that says, look, we do 10 and 12 episode runs, and that's what we expect from you. And then you get these padded and stretched out shows, some of which we've seen even on Netflix, where it has often felt like, 5 years ago in particular, it often felt like they had these 13 episode seasons that really should have been 6 or 8 episodes. And so I think Netflix can offer some of that. But the other thing is, I just want to add one more thing in here that I think is really important, is If you go back 25 years or so, maybe 30 years, to the mid-1990s, when HBO was on the precipice of becoming HBO as we know it now, right? Sort of going into Oz and The Sopranos and The Wire and Deadwood, sort of in that period
and
of time.
And Sex and the City.
Sex and the City, yes.
Don't forget Sex and the
in
City.
In that period of time when they were developing high cachet original programming. I forget who was the head of the HBO at the time, but the quote that I have always that I always remember was that he said, "I don't want to produce shows that get great marks from television critics. I want to produce shows that get talked about on the New York Times op-ed page." And so, of course, now we have, like, that's what HBO is known for, is shows that even if they have relatively small audiences, every single columnist for the New York Times op-ed page, or the Washington Post op-ed page, and et cetera, had, like, obsessively followed Game of Thrones and watches Succession. And okay, maybe not every single one, but, right, like, these shows have high cultural valence with a certain type of kind of upper middle class sort of creative, professional. And Netflix could, they certainly have the resources with that, with the kind of content budget that they're planning on spending this year and next year, and probably even if they cut back by 20%, they have the resources to bring in experienced professionals who have records of helping creatives develop shows that actually land cultural, have cultural footprints. And they could say, what we're going to do is maybe the budgets won't be quite as big, but we're going to pair you with somebody who knows how to do this, and we're going to make sure that the shows that you deliver actually get talked about. And there's a lot of creatives out there who will take a pay cut, who will work for less, who will do more, who will try to do more with less, if they actually have a reason to believe that they are going to be the thing that people talk about. And Netflix has just avoided that because they don't like advertising spending. They don't like marketing. What they want is just sort of what they've always done is deliver a content fire hose. And if they could deliver instead of a content fire hose, highly skilled content marksmanship, that is something they definitely could afford on their current budgets. And if they did that, they could still attract and retain creatives.
Yeah, but to do that, don't they need to rejigger their whole release strategy? I mean, the reason people don't talk about Netflix stuff is because you never have any idea where anybody is on any given show. I mean, I don't even like to tweet about what's going on in Stranger Things because I'm worried about a bunch of people yelling at me about spoilers.
Yeah, I've written about this a lot. I mean, you can literally see the conversations about Netflix shows like fall off the Google search ratings. Like they look like the Himalayas, whereas, get shows on Netflix or HBO like have much more of like they've got a I'm stretching this metaphor way too far, but they look like Monument Valley, where you have like these plateaus and buttes, and there's like an actual ongoing conversation for a while before things drop off again, and then you have it that repeatedly over a series of weeks, whereas Netflix shows peak momentarily and then disappear. I mean, they're just, the release strategy does not work for ongoing cultural conversation, like, at all.
But that's something they can adjust. And they have been resistant to doing so. But this is a moment of, like, at least potential crisis for them. This is a moment of rethinking. They were also resistant to ads for many years, and they're now developing an ad tier, that they are hoping to bring in people with. And look, they might not do this, but they absolutely have the resources, and they are not bound by a lot of the conventions of old Hollywood, deals with, they don't have the kind of legacy thinking built in that some studios have, that in some ways, Warner Brothers is helped in its creative endeavors by just having decades and decades of experience. At the same time, everybody who has worked for a big institution that has, or an institution that has a lot of history, knows that there is an awful lot, that train has momentum. And Netflix is still new enough and still potentially nimble enough that they could attract creatives if they decided, okay, let's use this as a reset moment, not only for advertisements, but also for the way that we develop our shows and build our products.
What do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Netflix is basically just kind of another studio at this point? Alyssa?
I think it's less controversial than inevitable, so I guess I'd say a non-controversy. You can only be the innovative big dog for so long until you run into some of the basic gravitational problems that all entertainment companies run into.
Peter.
I think it's a little bit controversial that they are out there saying, look, we still have our content budget, even as they are laying off people. It, I mean, at least a couple of hundred folks, as I understand, with maybe more on the way.
I think 150 so far, with obviously more on the way.
And that's that is notable for an organization that has so far relied on, we're just going to spend whatever we feel like spending, almost, you know, almost with, or at least we're going to try to create the appearance of having no spending controls. And they're still trying to create that appearance, even at a moment where they very clearly are going to be instituting some kinds of financial controls because of the way their business is going.
It's a controversy, I guess. I mean, I like the big question is how much they actually decide to change, and if they don't do something to like make the shows stickier and frankly just make them better. They like the quality control problem at Netflix is something crazy, and if they don't get a handle on it, it's just going to be nothing but the floor is lavas and is this cake and snowflake mountain. For the rest
and
of time.
And Squid Game,
them,
but which... for real. Aren't you excited, Sonny?
And Squid Game,
we're
gonna
do a...
Squid Game, but
I think
for
we're
going
to have to do a whole series of podcasts on Squid Game, but for real.
I'm disappointed in that show. It's already kind of sellout squish stuff.
Because there's
killing them.
Not enough murder is Sonny's main concern.
Are they going to have actual debtors be competing for the money?
Well, this is what I said on Twitter. Like I understand that they can't kill people, but they should have people who are horribly impoverished and in debt. So we have somebody to cheer for while they have their hopes and dreams stripped away from them. All right. So just a programming note. We're not going to have a bonus episode this week. We are actually taping in the past. We're far in the distant past taping this. So we're going to... we have some travel coming up, etc. Couldn't get a show together next week, so we're still doing this one. No bonus show, sorry. Now on to the main event. Netflix's Spiderhead. The newish film from star Chris Hemsworth and Miles Teller is written and produced by the guys who brought us the Deadpool movies, right? And it's directed by Joseph Kosinski, who is currently blowing away box office expectations with his Tom Cruise starring Top Gun Maverick. Lots of big names on this, in other words. You know, this should be a real big buzzy project, right? No, nobody's really talking about it. Netflix itself doesn't do much to promote their movies, and that they're no exception here. I didn't even know about this movie until it was like 10 days from release. I just saw it mentioned in a interview with Kosinski by Vulture Magazine's Bill G. Ibiri, and I was like, oh wait, a new Kosinski movie? I like him. Why haven't I heard about this? Because that's how Netflix rolls. And judging by the numbers, nobody's really watching it either. I mean, it's, you know, it's on the homepage. People checked it out, kind of. But in its first week of release, it came in second place to Adam Sandler's Hustle on the vaunted Netflix top 10 charts, right? Adam Sandler's movie has done about 135 million hours viewed or something like that over its first 2 weeks. And granted, Spiderhead only had 3 days, but it also only did 35.4 million hours viewed. Not super popular. All of which is to say, all of that run-up is a way of saying, this is just the Netflix film of the week. That's how it works. There are stars you recognize, there's talent behind the lens that's given kind of carte blanche to do what they want, and it's a pretty simple story that you can follow while folding your socks. Teller plays a prisoner on an island jail where he is the willing subject of psychological experiments at the hands of his jailer, who's played by Chris Hemsworth. The experiments involve mood-altering drugs. Some make you laugh uncontrollably, some make you incredibly horny, some make you terrified of anything and everything. You get the idea. As the film progresses, we learn more about Teller and his fellow inmates, including one he has a crush on. We learn about his crimes. He was charged with manslaughter after killing a friend, or I don't know, some version of homicide, after killing a friend during a drunk driving accident. We learn that Hemsworth is hiding something about what these drugs are intended to do and what all of his wards are doing there. There are some ideas here. This is a movie that has some ideas, right? Namely about the ethics of overriding free will via chemical coercion. How far should we go as a society to ensure order and protect the people? You know, that sort of thing. It's all a bit surface level. And again, that's fine. I'm not looking for an art house picture, just one that looks good. And this does look good, because Kaczynski's got a heck of an eye. It's got some amusing performances. I love Chris Hemsworth in this movie. He's kind of entertainingly goofy as the doctor slash pharma bro, who is often high on his own supply. It's a movie that's entertaining and amusing, without being particularly memorable or provocative. Again, it's the ideal Netflix movie of the week. That's what this is. There's a whole category. It's like we used to have the TNT Basic Cable Classic. Now we've got the Netflix movie of the week. It's better than competent, but less than great. I definitely don't regret having watched it, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend it to friends and family. Spiderhead, you could do worse. Peter, what did you make of this
picture? Well, it's definitely my favorite weird spinoff of the Spider-Man movie universe. I mean, it's better than Morbius. Like, I had a morbid good time here. I also sort of disagree with you that this movie kind of doesn't do anything with its ideas, because, like, I really think, like, this is a movie about how we all live in a prison, but it's a prison that we chose to be in, and that prison is late capitalism. Really? No, like, again, this is actually, I didn't quite hate this movie, but I really wanted more from it. I thought, you know, it's like, on the one hand, it's weirdly a lot like echoes Ex Machina, except it's not nearly as good. And you seem to like Chris Hemsworth in this, and I don't think he's bad exactly, but he seemed to be doing like a much more sort of bro-y, generic kind of surface comic version of what Oscar Isaac was doing as the weird tech zillionaire who, like, was playing mind games with everyone, and, like, you couldn't quite figure out what his motivations are. And Hemsworth just doesn't have the depth that Oscar Isaac does, and just isn't able to kind of deliver, I think, you know, something, the kind of the true weirdness that a role like this actually calls for. Now, granted, it's also not in the script. Like, the story just doesn't give him enough to work with. And so he's not bad exactly, but it's an odd bit of casting. And, like, his biceps are too big. They're too big for this role, right? Like, yes, I understand that he has like a little Stairmaster or like whatever, the rowing machine in his ridiculous apartment. But it just doesn't,
like, an exercise bike.
Yeah.
It's not even
no.
There's an arm,
there's a rowing machine exercise out on his deck, and I get it. He works out, sure. But, like, come on, it just doesn't. It's just bizarre how huge he is. Both just, I mean, in not just in stature, but in terms of his musculature, in a way that is distracting from the rest of the movie. As much as I like, I don't hate him, and I find him basically charming, but I think he's much better used in sort of shallower, like, more intentionally shallow fare, right? I think this movie is really indicative of my mixed feelings. It's a great demonstration of why I have mixed feelings about Joseph Kosinski. I have never, ever loved one of his movies, even though I don't think I've ever hated one either. And I was, I think, the only one here who found that Maverick sort of didn't quite, like, I didn't connect with it in the way that a lot of people did, even though I thought it was really quite well made, impressive, in this, you know, in terms of the plane photography and all of that. Kosinski just really loves these hyper-modern brutalist images and spaces, and he really loves this crisp production and lighting style, and I find those images very interesting to look at, but I also am always wondering, well, what's beneath them? And I can't find anything there to connect with. And that was true in the Tron sequel that he did. That was true in Oblivion. An interesting, but I think somewhat, like, not fully formed Tom Cruise movie that Kosinski also did. I thought that was true of Maverick in some ways as well. And this movie is similar in that it has this really precise, really stark visual style that is pleasing to the eye in a lot of ways and is technically impressive, but I don't know what it's actually trying to do, unless we go with, like, the dumb, oh man, we're all just living in, you know, late capitalism by choice, like, we've chosen to limit our freedoms, we live in a prisons of our own, like, but it's not actually enough of an idea to carry the movie, and it seems to me like Kosinski almost doesn't care what kind of ideas carry his movies. He just is there for the imagery. And as much as I like it, I want a little bit more.
Well, I think he is in a way kind of a classic studio craftsman. He's the sort of guy who a studio could turn to and make one of these movies every 18 months or so, or 12 months or so without too much problem. He does not strike me as a big ideas guy as far as, like, compared to, say, Chris Nolan or Denis Villeneuve or, you know, somebody like that.
Well, he certainly doesn't deliver on the ideas. And I think that's, I guess, maybe the thing that bugs me here is that Spiderhead and Oblivion in particular seem to gesture at bigger ideas. And yet what? Like, what are, like, they don't get you anywhere, right? You're just like, oh, in the end, it's Tom Cruise and a bunch of Tom Cruise weird clones because it's just an AI running this triangle ship. Man, that looks really cool. Does look really cool. It does.
It did look really cool. It was a very nice... I like Oblivion a lot. I like it more now than I did when it came out. In part because when it came out, it just felt like such a pastiche of sci-fi tropes. But once you get past the sci-fi, like all of the cobbled together sci-fi elements, it's actually just really fun to watch and look at and listen to. It's got
it's fun to look at. But his movies are just... His movies seem like kind of empty design objects to me. And as much as I like beautiful empty design, they are empty.
Alyssa, what did you make of Spiderhead?
So I think it's interesting that both of you brought up the visuals in this movie and Kaczynski's sort of attention to the visual in general, because I think Spiderhead is a really interesting test case in concepts, whether a concept is best executed through cinema or through words. And, you know, this is based on a George Saunders short story, Escape from Spiderhead. And the story does something that the movie is just not capable of, which it takes you inside someone who is having his emotions and his brain manipulated, and it helps you understand what it's like, for example, to feel, you know, go from feeling inarticulate to incredibly articulate, and then to have that articulateness sort of seep away and have the memory of it but not be able to access it, or to have the feeling of being incredibly attracted to someone and, you know, to love being with them sexually and emotionally in the moment, and then the sort of odd emptiness of having that feeling withdrawn. And that's not something that I think is captured particularly well in this movie, in part because it is so interior that I'm not sure even the finest performance could describe it. In the same way, some of the horrors of the movie are actually, I think, blunted for being visual rather than in words. Spoiler alert here, in one sequence, Chris Hemsworth's character basically tortures a woman by giving her a drug called Darkenflux that basically makes her feel as bad as you can possibly feel. And she, you know, as you would feel if you were subjected to that and were unable to turn it off and it sort of came over you irrationally, becomes incredibly self-destructive to the point that she stabs herself in the neck and kills herself. And it's not pleasant to watch, but, you know, Saunders' writing of the scene is, I think, much more upsetting. And if you guys will forgive me, I'm going to read it here just because I think the language is so interesting, in part because it leaves these lacunas that let you fill in something really horrible for yourself. So Saunders writes, "In each workroom was a couch, a desk, and a chair, all by design impossible to disassemble. Heather now began disassembling her impossible to disassemble chair. Her face was a mask of rage. She drove her head into the wall. Like a wrathful prodigy, Heather, beloved of someone, managed in her great sadness-fueled rage to disassemble the chair while continuing to drive her head into the wall." "Jesus," Verlaine said. "Verlaine, buck up," Abnesty said. "Jeff, stop crying. Contrary to what you might think, there's not much data in crying. Use your words. Don't make this in vain." "I used my words. I spoke volumes, was precise. I described and redescribed what I was feeling as I watched Heather do what she now began doing, intently, almost beautifully, to her face slash head with one of the chair legs." I mean, that's really scary writing, right? It is, you know, it implies something. You know, you have this character whose articulateness has literally been hyped up with a drug called Verbaloose. So he should have words for what he's seeing. We, in fact, know that he has some words because he's, you know, using them, just not to us. But the implication is that what is happening is so terrible that it cannot even be described. And it lets the reader fill in with their own mind what their version of that terrible thing is, right? And I find that, I mean, you know, that scene in the movie, it's like, it's a little bit sad, it's a little bit gross, it's a little bit upsetting, but it comes nowhere close to the sort of that interplay of evocative language with spaces left in at carefully calibrated intervals for you to fill in the most horrifying thing you can think of. And I mean, I think that scene, you know, in its two forms is an excellent way of talking about, you know, is something better suited to be cinema or is it better suited to be prose? And, you know, the short story is different in a lot of ways, but I found this, you know, sort of infinitely superior as prose because it captures, the prose is creepier than the movie. You know, brutalism and sort of weirdness of the movie inside, the prose is much, much more unsettling than the movie. And by kind of filling in those spaces for you, the movie actually leeches away some of the horrors of the concept in a way that I thought, you know, were sort of an interesting test case, but not particularly effective as a movie.
What did you make of the soundtrack here, Alyssa? I mentioned this briefly in regards to some of his other movies, but this feels very. Whereas Tron Legacy had a great Daft Punk soundtrack and Oblivion had a great M83 soundtrack, this feels like kind of a perfunctory 80s.
She Blinded Me with Science, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it's just like, it's super obvious, right? And it feels much more, especially since the soundtrack is, I think, sort of supposed to be a reflection of Hemsworth's like mad scientist character. It felt sort of too obvious in a way to be really unnerving.
So it's interesting you bring up his use of music, just because if you guys know his origin story, Joseph Kosinski's like breakout was not a movie. It was a commercial for the video game Gears of War, which is a big kind of dumb sci-fi, it's smart dumb sci-fi action series through Xbox. And in, I want to say 2006, he produced an ad for, I think it was the first one, that was set to, that set images from the video game to the song Mad World. And this was, at the time, one of the most sort of cinematic, evocative and moody interpretations of video game imagery that I think anybody had ever seen. And it became sort of iconic on its own. And so he is somebody who I think one of his strengths is just sort of drawing out mood and sort of, I don't know, it's like a create like a tone from the combination of music and images. I actually thought that a lot of the musical choices worked reasonably well here, even if nothing he ever makes is gonna music wise is gonna work as well as that that Daft Punk scene in the middle of Tron Legacy, where like they're at the bar and it's all about to happen, and like the DJs who are played by Daft Punk are just like, oh, there's everybody's fighting here and about to digitally murder each other. Let's get the right soundtrack, the right music on. And it's such a great little beat. Again, though, it's perfect Kosinski beat in that it's just like, let's adjust the mood and the tone. Let's adjust the aesthetics of this scene so that they are perfect and precise. But what is this in service of? It's in service of perfect, precise aesthetics and not much of anything else.
What did you guys make of the closing bit where everything goes kind of nuts? Because I've seen some people say they don't really like this, the final half of the last act, where Miles Teller and his lady friend are trying to break out of the prison, and Chris Hemsworth says, you got to get these guys before they go. And then it just, there's like a genuine tone shift, I think, from like to a sort of comic violence, which I actually liked a lot. I liked it because it felt like it worked in tune with everything else that was going on in the movie at that point. I like, for people who haven't watched it, the drugs are controlled by a little pack in their backs. Basically, Miles Teller puts Chris Hemsworth all out of whack. His you know, back drugs are all messed up, and that's when things spiral out of control. Everything goes crazy from there. It felt like it reflected the actual tone of the story at that point. But I also can understand why people did not like the shift, because it is a pretty big swing. It's a big move.
It seemed to me like they didn't know how to, like, this was it seemed sort of like a cop-out to me. I guess I didn't hate it, but it also seemed like, well, they couldn't write themselves out of their main scenario in the same tone. And so they were just like, all right, I guess everything goes crazy, and that's how it ends.
Yeah, it did nothing. It did nothing for me. I mean, the ending of the short story, which I recommend you read instead of watching the movie, is very different, and I think sort of like much darker and sort of more interesting. But I think the ending also kind of gets at the weirdness of the movie's capitalism metaphor. Like, you know, because throughout the movie, Miles Teller's character Jeff thinks that there is, you know, that he is part of sort of a larger corporate experiment with like a review, you know, a scientific review board, that like this is to a, you know, this may be sort of icky and weird, but it is like a professionally run trial. And at the end of the movie, it's revealed that Hemsworth's character is like the sort of the sole owner of this company, that he, you know, is that there is no control board, that he's sort of just running this demented experiment like on his own. And that actually makes the movie less scary and interesting. Like, if the Spiderhead facility is just the creation of like a demented rich guy, then it doesn't actually say anything about capitalism or about corporate America or about sort of the wider use of mood altering drugs, all of which are really like, those are good and interesting subjects for a movie. But if you take it, you know, if the responsibility here is just like one evil rich guy's and he kills himself and therefore the problem is solved, then the movie is saying less than it, you know, the sort of slimmed down version of what it purports to.
All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down, Alyssa?
Thumbs down. Read the George Saunders short story. It will take less of your time, and there will be greater reward.
Peter?
Thumbs down, but it's kind of an intriguing thumbs down. Like, I'm not actually upset that I watched it, but maybe I've just got some I-36 being pumped into my veins.
I find it ridiculous that you gave Lightyear a thumbs up and this a thumbs down.
Lightyear is a more competent film. It Lightyear delivers more on its premise. It's not a great movie, but it's a better movie than Spiderhead.
Your standards are meaningless. I'll give it a thumbs up, light thumbs up. All right, that is it for this week's show. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.